attention. I can't get no call to action, but I try and I try and I try.
Hello and welcome to Call to Action, the go-to podcast for anyone trying to make sense of the world of marketing, business and beyond. In an industry that is a minefield of utter bollocks, we aim to capture our heroes and allies from the front line to have a chinwag with. It's like Pokemon Go, with the single but vital exception that it's not a short-term bandwagon of shite. It's brought to you by Gasp and I'm Giles Edwards. This week, we handcuffed ourselves to the most interesting person we could find, and now we have to attend a course, all to demonstrate our connection-making credentials to the master of the art, legendary community builder, and this week's guest, Ollie Barrett, MBE. Frequently referred to as a super connector, which is a different thing from a superconductor and even differenter from a super noodle, Ollie is a UK-based entrepreneur and presenter known for his uncanny ability to spark new ventures through bringing together the right people, ideas, and investment. Over the years, he's breathed life into all sorts of social change campaigns and initiatives, including Tenor, the UK's largest schools entrepreneurship competition, and Turn On the Subtitles, a global literacy push encouraging subtitles on children's TV to improve reading skills. Unifying the not always compatible worlds of innovation, education, and social impact, Ollie has been deservedly recognized for his talent, vision, and drive, earning him the title of Wired's Most Connected Man in Britain, a spot in GQ's Top 100 Connected Figures, and the small matter of an actual MBE pinned to his immaculate lapels in 2013 for services to business and entrepreneurship. Ollie says, "I'm a great believer that creativity is mainly joining ideas and people up." Welcome to the show, Ollie.
Thank you, Giles. What a lovely introduction. I can't stop thinking about Pokemon now. We've got to catch them all.
Do you see what they're doing now? I saw a thing in the news earlier, the way it's fantastic, isn't it? Well, impressive at least.
Huge sort of data collection effort. Right from the start, we should have known.
We should have known. It's funny because my intro riles so many people because clearly Pokemon Go is anything but a short-term bandwagon of shite, but I do enjoy poking fun at it. So seven quick-fire questions. Ollie, Leeds or Edinburgh?
Oh, well, Edinburgh. I should explain, I dropped out of both universities, but for its cultural magnetism, much as I still love Leeds, I say Edinburgh.
People or ideas?
Oh, it's got to be people, hasn't it? I'm sort of unbelievably in love with people, and people are the connectors of ideas, really, aren't they?
Nice. Yeah, well played. Right, a nod to school now. This will mean nothing to most people. Hawks or falcons?
Neither. Kestrels, Giles. The bird of prey. As an inveterate hoverer, I have to say that.
Butlins or Disney World?
Oh, wow. Now we're talking, aren't we? Got to be Disney World, only because of the lifelong friendships I met when I was working there.
Nice. Including Mickey.
Yeah, I'm taking the Mickey.
Jeremy Paxman or Louis Theroux?
We've got to be Louis Theroux. Much as I love and respect Jeremy Paxman, Louis's ability to wind up Demi McGee in all the right ways. Curiouser and curiouser. And I watched him on telly two nights ago. He's fresh in my head.
Yes. Okay. Fantastic. Right. Two more. The Hunger Games or the Hunger Games on stage?
Well, I'm so excited to see Troubadour Theatres bringing the Hunger Games to stage in Canary Wharf. It's got to be that. Live is best.
Fantastic. And then lastly, the BBC have described you as both. So which one are you? Uni dropout or successful entrepreneur?
Oh, certainly uni dropout if I had to choose one. Slightly horrified my mother reading that particular headline. I think she'd been slightly pretending to some friends that I'd been to both Leeds and Edinburgh. So,
oh, wonderful.
I was revealed, but, you know, I slightly saw dropout as a badge of honour back then, I suppose, if I'm honest.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a funny term, right? Dropout. Because actually, just for our listeners' sake, the context of that article was effectively to announce the fact you had been awarded an MBE. So I'm sure that balanced things up for Mummy Barrett.
Well, and indeed, some of the rest of my family who had not been quite sure until that point, A, what I was doing, and B, if it had any merit whatsoever. I'm half joking. But there was at least somebody out there who recognised it.
Fantastic. Right, Ollie, so we always ask every guest about their path to where they are now and find that it's rarely a linear one. You've already alluded to your, success? I think there's certainly success within the dropout tag at Leeds and Edinburgh. But can you talk a little bit about the early years and how it led to your kind of first jobs and what you regard to be your first proper job?
Well, it was certainly linear. It's just the line in question was a massive zigzag. That was the only real problem. And this will be whistle stop, Giles, for your listeners' benefit, but did the A-levels, but then I found they did an international scheme at Disney World. So there you are, 6 months working at Epcot Center, plunged into this working environment with 11 different other nationalities, working together, living together. So what that gave me an injection of was the joy of working with people from all around the world and Disney world class in looking after people. And in fact, it made me realize there's a lot about business which boils down to looking after people. So I sprung off the back of that, off to Edinburgh I go. French and Spanish was the course I studied. And it quickly dawned on me sitting in that lecture theater, I'm not going to last 4 years of this. I found it actually, I'm sure it was very good and renowned and credible. I found it quite dry. Can I say that? I thought, I'm not going to last the course here for 4 years. So I dropped out. And because I dropped out, to my parents' surprise, I was the first in the family to go to university, the first to drop out. I had a look around for what else I could do because no other course would let me on straight away. So I had another few months to kill. And at that point, I headed off to work for a kids' TV company, firstly in London and then in New York. And then I latched on to what became a much more successful course for me, which was a BBC-trained course in broadcasting. So there already I've worked in some bars and hotels. I've done a 6-month stint at Disney World, and I've headed into my second course. And to be perfectly honest, Giles, the second course is where I ended up starting my first business. So the world of what we might call formal employment never really came knocking.
How long did you collectively last, if we can put it that way, in Edinburgh and Leeds?
You sound like gladiators. I started my first business in my second year of Leeds Uni.
Yeah.
And by the time I did drop out again, we had recruited in 9 cities around the UK, 150 people to put on alternative careers events. So this was me and my business partner, my co-founder. By that time, I was juggling the course. I had an office in Leeds, an office in London, 150 brilliant students around the country running events. So it was a good 2 years. I like to think they kept the door open for me to come back. I just didn't manage to make it.
Yeah. Well, funny enough, there was another line in that BBC article, which was dates back to 2013, which I highlighted, which defined your spells at Edinburgh and Leeds as unsuccessful. I feel like you could challenge the BBC on that word.
Well, I think they've got a very good point, haven't they? Let's not forget, it was free at that point for me to go off to Edinburgh. And that makes a big difference. I've got quite mixed feelings about it, though, Giles, because I was sharing with a colleague last week, I would probably go all over again and I'd probably drop out all over again, which I don't think makes much sense as advice. I think if we had longer, we could unpack I think the whole thing of uni needs a big redesign, if I'm honest.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree at all. I know you know Mark Lewis at SCA, and I think their model kind of makes a lot more sense. And I've heard him talk quite passionately about the university system needing a fix of sorts. I wonder, though, do you believe it was your time at Disney World, which presumably differed so much from what you would typically find with people starting university, did that just open your eyes slightly more than most people, which is why you weren't prepared to sit in a lecture theatre for so long? I say you're not prepared to. I kind of put words in your mouth there that you were some rowdy oik, but there we go. Too late to take it back.
Open my eyes in a way. I mean, I'd just say it activated me in the sense of, I don't mean as some sort of little mini Greta Thunberg with Disney ears. I mean, it just made me come alive, because what you're actually doing is, and I wasn't anywhere near, or certainly close to playing the characters, I was selling sherry trifles on a cart in a make-believe United Kingdom pavilion, and down the road you had France and then Italy and then Japan and then China and so on. But what it meant was you were meeting members of the public every day from across the world, across different generations, who were there to have a really good time. And it was that permission that they weren't frowning at you with their arms folded, going, who the heck are you? They were already up for having a nice conversation. So I think that gave me this extraordinary sheep dip, if you like, of socializing professionally. And then there was the other international layer. So I met people from all around the world. And even on a UK level, meeting some of my future best mates from everywhere, from Torquay to Hull, and keeping in touch with them 30 years later. So it completely, it didn't just blow my mind. It just changed my life.
Yeah. But presumably one of the things that university is famous for, and it's perhaps not celebrated enough when we're kind of too binary and we see it as a route to get a degree, is the networking period that you do get to enjoy post your previous education.
Yeah, you know, I'm also not convinced that uni does anything like what it could do to help you to meet your fellow students. It all seems to me, even now, to be left to chance. I think it could be, I mean, some people would hate this, but I think it could be far more structured. I mean, really, what do the leading universities of today do to equip and enable their students to meet each other? I'm not sure. I mean, I'm very happy to be proved wrong on that. I just think, A, if it's a chance to meet each other, how can we structure it better? B, and by the way, uni is about much more than getting a good job, right? If you just focus on the getting a great job bit, how convinced are we that our leading employers are directly involved in the course design, like Mark Lewis at the SCA, of what students are experiencing? And again, I'm not quite sure they are embedded in the ways that they could be.
No, I think there's certainly a mismatch. You only have to look at the success of, say, Mark Ritson's mini MBA, which you might be familiar with. We've worked with Mark and the team there on the course itself, but we've recommended it to kind of clients and peers alike. And it's amazing how many clients who have done what they would kind of refer to as bunny ears, a proper MBA, who then come out and say, well, actually, that 12 weeks was far superior than the years I spent at University X.
I tell you what saved me very briefly. I saw a little flyer for something called the SIS, not MI6, but the Student Industrial Society. And that was this offsite. It sounds terribly dull. It wasn't, because it was this offsite where you were put into teams. You were given an imaginary challenge. In our case, it was think of a bid for an imaginary Olympics at some date in the future. And all of a sudden, I was working in teams. I was being creative. We were writing everything from the theme tune to the marketing pitch. You were being coached by people from Barclays or Accenture or whatever. I thought, maybe all is not lost. Maybe I could be all right, because I absolutely loved that. And it was genuinely a bit of a lifeline at the time.
Yeah. And you're being taught by people who are proper frontline, actually involved.
Exactly. Exactly that. And not sat on your backside in a lecture theatre gazing out the window.
Yeah. You shouldn't do that, Ollie.
Well, it's a bit rude of me, isn't it? I mean, there are some amazing lectures and lecturers. And I'm sure I had some, but it just wasn't the right fit for me at that time, I'm afraid. That's the point.
Yeah, and also, you know, people learn in all sorts of manners of ways, right? And sometimes sitting in a lecture theatre and being talked to is not, you know, not the most productive for some, and there's nothing wrong with that. So post-SIS then, is that what kind of sparked you and kind of made you want to get more involved in working collaboratively and creating and innovating?
Definitely. And what ended up happening in other ways, like with a student radio show, with, you know, theatre productions, musical productions. And by the way, this went back right the way through, believe it or not, to when I was a 10-year-old or thereabouts school child, where I always remember, and we are going back decades now, I do realise that, but I always remember being told that I hadn't got the part I wanted in a particular production, Wind in the Willows, I'm Not Bitter. And then I was asked, instead, would I be interested in helping produce it? And again, that changed my life in a funny way, because I was helping put the ingredients together. And that became the thing I was more interested in, frankly, than ever appearing on the stage or anything like that. And that followed through to, as I say, radio, to theatre. And it turns out, fast forward to the year 2000, that the guy directing a musical that I was producing ended up becoming my first business partner. So the stage was totally different, right? But the role was similar, bringing the people together.
Yeah. And what was that first partnership?
That was, do you mean the show or the business?
No, the business.
The business. It was called Amazing You. And it was, I wouldn't say a rebellion, but it was definitely an aversion to the careers fair, which to this day and too many places is only about very large companies and only about dressing up in grey suits and pretending to be adults. Whereas I thought it would be, or we thought it would be more fun to have student-led events in much more interesting places, bars, coffee shops, and where the companies present were small, medium-sized companies doing a whole variety of interesting things. And then at the core of it, long story short, was a venture center where if you wanted to start your own thing, you could meet your co-founder there as well. So yeah, I was hopefully quite ambitious. It was a bit different, but we were very motivated to get that going.
And how do you categorize those first sorts of partnerships and initiatives you got into? Because if I crudely do it, it sounds like you were very focused on enabling people.
Yeah, I think so. Certainly that was, because it was about, yeah, of course, technically as a business, it was about helping the employers get to students. The Trojan horse bit was, I was actually much more interested in creating environments where the students could meet each other. So that is definitely true.
Yeah, okay. But innovation is also a thread, because you ended up in San Francisco soon after.
Yeah. What was happening was I'd moved to London. I'd already started, by the way, Punchline, the first business had failed. I'd met my next business partner through a chance encounter with Simon Woodroffe, the sushi king.
Yes.
Who had brought my next business partner along to a drink we'd had. I'd started my first social initiative, which we might touch on, which was the £10 scheme. So the first 10,000 tenners have gone out the door. And everyone around me at the time was talking about innovation and Silicon Valley. And I had never been. And I thought, this is bugging me now. I really want to go. So you're absolutely right. I put together what a listener might think of as a thinly veiled beano, which was a mission to San Francisco. So I thought, let's take 20 brilliant companies to the West Coast for a week. And that started another chain reaction. But again, I suppose I'm an instigator, aren't I? But I am literally incapable of doing anything on my own. So it's always right at the start thinking, who else is up for this and why?
Time, weather, and...
We interrupt this podcast to announce that we will never interrupt this podcast with ads. Ads that awkwardly nudge you to contact the pod's host, Giles Edwards. Only last week, some pod-listening companies did just that, calling for guidance on proper marketing. But we're not asking you to do that. Nope. Anyway, back to the show.
Marketing is incredibly confused with sales.
I think you're the one who's more confused, Gary V, sunshine. Here we go.
Can you just give us a loose overview of what Tenor is, but more importantly, how it came about?
Well, only what happened was I was asked to go and give a talk in a school to these, school kids sat cross-legged, cross-armed and all that. And I don't think the talk went particularly well, but what I did definitely think afterwards was I was not convinced that giving talks, powerful as they can be, was the optimal way to inspire students to start something. I didn't have the answer as to what would have been better, but I was frustrated that I hadn't hit the mark, if that makes sense. And that very afternoon, I read a newspaper article about a vicar in Suffolk who'd raised money for church repairs by giving his congregation money. And I thought, that's very odd. What was he up to? He'd said, anyone that wants a £10 note can have one. Go and do whatever you like within reason, and whatever profit you make, give it to the church. And the punchline was he raised thousands of pounds, and the biggest money spinner was a lady in her 80s making jam and reinvesting the profits. And, you know, lightning struck. That's the idea. Why not make it as entertaining as possible? Why not do it in schools with 10,000 kids in the first year?
Yeah. That's incredible. And how was that received? I mean, I know the answer, but...
Well, I think with sort of shock, in the sense that I think probably 9 out of 10 or maybe 10 out of 10 of the people I mentioned it to said, well, definitely don't do it with more than about 10 people in the first year. Somebody said, are you sure? Because I said, let's give them a month. 4 out of 5 said, I don't think that's long enough, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, I think sometimes, and your listener is much more into this and capable of this than I, but the trick is to make something remarkable so that it can cut through. So for me, 10,000 kids, 1 month, 1 challenge. And again, I didn't know the schools. I partnered with an amazing campaign. I worked with amazing individuals, Tom Savage, Scott Kane, who were already embedded in a campaign which knew lots of schools. So again, it's a bit like that stone soup fairy story. You know, if you've got the stone and the pot to cook in, lots of the other ingredients then start to present themselves.
Mm. Yeah, fantastic. Well, Tenor is in its 20th year now, I believe.
That's right. It got adopted by Young Enterprise. I think maybe 40,000 school kids a year still do it. It's got a little cousin or sister called Fiverr in primary schools.
Fantastic.
And, you know, one of the twists we made was that we asked the kids to give back the tenor. And we were told that was mad. And in the first year, 99% of the money came back. And that's really? Partly why it's still going.
That's fantastic. Have you got, do you know, surely you have a few stories about what students got up to and what sorts of businesses started. Have you got any favourites that spring to mind?
So someone came up to me last week at an event, literally an event in the city last week. And they said, this was a colleague working on an event that I was hosting. And they said, Ollie, can I just say, thanks so much for starting Fiverr. And I thought, oh, that's nice. He's a parent or something like that. And he said, yeah, I did it. And bear in mind, this is the primary school version. So that made me feel obviously ancient. The one that always sticks in my mind was some kids who'd been by the seaside. And I was interviewing them about what they'd done with their money. And they'd got some pebbles from the shore and painted them to look like little insects and animals and put them in a shoebox. And I said, that is brilliant. That is very creative. What did you sell each one for? Because they'd made quite a bit of money. I think they made about £80 in a day. And they looked at me like I was mad. They said, well, we didn't sell them. We covered over the box and we charged 50p a look.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic.
And
that is so good.
And there they were with their service model. Completely confounding all my expectations. And it just stopped me in my tracks. I was like, I've got so much to learn from you.
50p and look.
Again, it's just that sheer variety. But on a serious note, I was always interested in the stories, but I was never that interested in, relatively speaking, I'm less interested in what they did and how much money they made. The secret, without sounding terribly pious, I was very interested in the idea that it might somehow change the way they felt about themselves. And that was really why we did it.
I've heard you in a previous interview you gave make the point that education shouldn't feel like you're in the back seat. So I think anything like Tenor, or even we had Alex Horn on last year and he talked about taking Taskmaster into schools. Anything that's more active and engaging just feels like such a wonderful, not just a break from the norm, but it kind of offers itself to an educational experience in a way, in a completely different way to how it would usually manifest in that environment.
I think it's huge. I think the most worrying thought is that somebody thinks they're in the passenger seat of their own life. I used to have a recurring dream that I was careering downhill in the backseat of a car. And I think a lot of school, if we're not careful, makes you think like you're a passenger. And the trick is to make people think they can be in the driver's seat. I think it's completely essential. And I think the quickest way to do that is give them mini experiences, without sounding patronizing, but small experiences and encounters which enable them to experience what it's like to have ideas and make them happen. I can get terribly serious about this, but I do think it can be as playful as you like. If we're not baking that into every school, every workplace, then we're definitely off on the wrong foot.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. What did Tenor change for you? Because presumably that gave you kind of, you must have taken so much from it. The satisfaction alone must have felt wonderful, albeit I imagine it was it didn't become what it is now overnight. But did that give you, did that make you feel like you were more in the driver's seat, so to speak, in terms of other things and initiatives you could get involved in?
Definitely. I loved that. You know, I wrote to the editor of Newsnight at the time, and they wrote back and made three films, which got us on Breakfast News and Newsround. And it really encouraged me, quotes, to think big, because we were making up those numbers as in the target number of 10,000 kids. And so if anything, I wish we'd aimed even bigger. It definitely proved to me that you don't have to have all the ingredients when you're starting something. And half the art is finding the right partners who have got the other bits of the jigsaw. It definitely proved that. I'll never forget standing in the Houses of Parliament. We're being hosted by one of the deputy speakers and we'd invited some of the winners down. And one of them, I didn't even say it to me, I just overheard him saying it. We'd invited him down from not that far away. It was probably 2 hours away on the train. And he said, I never thought I'd see Big Ben with my own eyes. I found that really weirdly moving. You know, I just thought, how can you give more people around the country not a glimpse of what it's like to come to London? Quite the opposite, but just that sense of what's possible. So it did shift a lot, and no one asked me to do it. No one paid me to do it. So it also slightly gave me permission just to do stuff in that world. It didn't give me permission. It encouraged me to keep doing stuff. And sorry, final point. It definitely brought home, I know I've said you don't have to have all the pieces of the jigsaw, but finding amazing people to work with. I don't consider myself the founder of anything, really. It's, you know, it's all about who can come on this adventure with me, and would there be something in them that would make it fun for them as well?
Yeah. Yeah, fantastic. You use the word permission there. Funny enough, when I scribbled down your points about education, feeling like you're in the passenger seat, or shouldn't feel like that, I should say, I wrote down, is it because we all wait for permission? Like, there seems to be a moment where you're either losing time waiting for someone to tell you, oh, by the way, you can actually direct your life, your education. But permission seems to be a big one that holds people back.
Yeah, I think that's right. And in lots of organizations, you will literally have, oh, I'm a level this, and the levels might be numbered or lettered. So that idea that you can write to anyone, whether or not it's now the done thing, but you can call anyone up, you can say hi to anyone. It's often against how people think. And I've met so many bosses, if you call it that, leaders, who on the one hand, they say, you know, my door is always open. And on the other, they quietly confide that they're always amazed how few people walk through it. That you could easily say maybe they're not making themselves as accessible enough as they should. But there's a really interesting block there.
Yeah. In the quickfires at the start, you kind of unpacked why you chose people ahead of ideas. And I think it's quite clear now. You talk about people being such critical component parts, if that doesn't sound like I'm kind of dehumanizing them. You're obviously one of the most connected people in Britain. How do people go about creating those connections and networking? Because again, I've heard you talk about networking. The word itself has a slightly awkward reputation. But what is the trick to assembling the right people and component parts?
Well, I think before that thought of assembling them, it sounds a bit like the Avengers, doesn't it? I think there are a few habits or techniques that can feel weird, and you just have to, or I would encourage anyone just to practice, and with a view to getting a little bit better at. And the first, very briefly, the first is just literally just saying hello to people. And that could be in the corridor, it could be outside an event, it could be inside an event. What we tend to do is hang around the people we already know. So I think if you can get better at that, or use that phrase, you know, do you mind if I just say hi? The flip side of that is most people don't tend to be very good at keeping in touch. So I think that has to, we have to get better. If we want to have a great network, we just, you know, it's so easy to lose touch. And I don't consider still being connected on LinkedIn really keeping in touch. You know, keeping in touch is, you know, there's a connection there and they have an idea what you're up to and vice versa. And what's the point of all this, Giles? I think better networks help us make stuff happen. And they also magnetize us for more interesting opportunities, not just in work, but more generally in life. So for me, the key to putting great people together is being in touch with them in the first place. The thing that supercharged it for me was becoming a host of my own little gatherings, and some of them became bigger gatherings. And a twist I put on that quite early on, actually, was I'd encourage guests to bring someone that was totally different to them, either generationally or from a totally different industry. So I'll host a breakfast tomorrow morning. And I know that a large number of the guests have come because they are trusted, but very different to the people I've already invited.
That's genius. I remember Rich Huntington talking about advising strategists if they're about to go on a long train journey to buy a magazine that they would never normally buy, which has a kind of pattern breaking, objective to it too.
Well, it could get you in trouble, couldn't it? I also think that draws the eye sometimes of your fellow passenger. A friend of mine, Natalie Campbell, carried around a yellow notebook for years because it would get her more comments. I think having something remarkable on or about your person that sparks conversation. I mean, that might sound a bit gimmicky, but I think all these things matter.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. If we look across other things you've helped start, so I do want to talk about Turn On The Subtitles. They presumably, many if not most, start as relatively simple ideas that then grow. And I know we've talked about people and they grow via people, but how do you, what have you learned about persuading people to join these ideas early on? It feels so fragile and uncertain, or can do in its early days. And in the context of the industry and the agency that I run, I think you learn quite quickly that having ideas isn't necessarily the hard bit. It's getting them made and getting them sold. And that's something that you can really underestimate early in your career. And I think it's why so many kind of creatives have bad reputations, because they're famously not always great at accepting that something won't be made. So how do you go from nurturing these ideas to then getting them made and persuading people to join you?
So for me, it's always depended completely on having the right co-founder, if you like. You know, Turn On The Subtitles wouldn't exist without a guy called Henry Warren, without a brilliant woman called Nina Hale, Ditto VIY, where kids fix their own youth clubs. That's now had thousands of kids go through it, get a qualification, lots of corporate support, City and Guilds qualifications. You know, it doesn't exist without Tim Redding and Ed Selwood. I think, although it's quite the rage to say, you know, ideas are easy, ideas are cheap, but you didn't say those words, I do think there's something special about a beautifully simple, powerful idea. So again, give kids the tools to fix their own youth clubs. On subtitles, did you know that if you put on subtitles on children's television, you will double the chance of them becoming a good reader? All right. That is so powerful, I think it deserves a place in the bullseye. And by the way, that's not my insight. That's research of an amazing guy, Bridge Kataria, out of India and San Francisco, Planet Read. To me, that had bullseye qualities about it that just said, this is beautifully simple. It's hugely scalable. How do we make it work? And when you're looking for co-founders, you're looking for people that believe in the potential and the simplicity, the beauty and the simplicity of the idea. And then when you're looking for partners, it's always thinking, and again, without teaching your listener to suck eggs, it's saying, well, what is the value exchange? And if the value exchange is lopsided, then this is only going to last for a very short time. Whereas, you know, I knew that by asking, or we thought that by asking Wix, the DIY chain, to give the kit and materials, it had to work for them in other ways. It had to be an excuse for them to talk to their trade customers, who in turn would get more business out of doing these volunteering shifts and so on. It had to stack up for the school's partners for Turn On The Subtitles. So sort of calculating that initially on the back of an envelope that then gives it that longevity. And then if anything else, I think recognizing early on that you haven't necessarily got time to convince a lot of people. So you are often looking in those early stages for people, and I use a cliche, people who just get it and love it. And I always remember, thanks to Mike and Shuna, Mike Dixon, Shuna Kennedy, introducing us to a property firm, Annington, for Turn On The Subtitles. And I was a little bit cheeky. I said, this might not be the one for you. This is the curveball. This is the,
right,
this is the maverick pitch of the day. Because you'd be funding us to make connections. And 20 minutes later, we got the text saying, we're backing you.
Amazing. And what does that mean, they're backing you, just in terms of resource?
That, I mean, as it happened for me, it was always going to be a pro bono thing. We did need money to pay for a great team to grip it. As it turned out, they also brought some brilliant insights. They'd supported literacy schemes before. They introduced other partners to us as well. But it meant cash. And over the course of time, it meant cash over 3 years, which was a game changer. They did also accept, A, the power of the connector getting us in the room, but B, saying this might not be for you, this is a bit different, rather than trying to please everyone.
Yeah. Well, that makes complete sense. And just for our listeners who might not be familiar, that it was as simple as making sure the default for subtitles wasn't set to off.
Yeah. In the end, we did a schools campaign. We got Stephen Fry and Jack Black in the US to do a more public-facing campaign. We ended up hopefully encouraging a lot of parents to turn the subtitles on. Sky created a whole new literacy zone where the subtitles sort of burnt onto their content. Our ultimate point remains that actually it is about the power of defaults. If you stick them on by default, actually very few kids will turn them back off again, believe it or not. And we've shown that through research with Nesta. As a secret benefit, you're changing the reading of potentially millions of kids.
Yeah. At home, I've always had the subtitles on ever since I heard about this idea, which must be, you know, a good 5 years ago now. So, it's absolutely genius. It's amazing that power of a default, right? I'm sure. Is it in Singapore where you have to opt out of organ donation?
Yeah, it's in quite a few countries now. I think it's more widely across the UK even. Certainly Wales did it. I remember working on an organ donor campaign in the UK, which really zeroed in on that as just hugely powerful. You know, the single biggest driver of organ donation signatures back in the day was Boots, because they put it as a box on their Advantage card.
They just made it accessible.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing. I'm sure it was, I'm sure it was probably a story Rory Sutherland shared in the past, but there was a restaurant in France which was struggling to get its patrons to turn their phones off. And after having a sign, an unsuccessful sign asking people to do just that on the way in, they changed it to read something along the lines of, please remember to turn your phone back on when you leave. Just to kind of hint at the norm within the restaurant. It's just beautiful.
I love it.
Absolutely beautiful.
I love it. I'm so interested in bringing together super smart marketeers around social problems worth solving. I think there's such an interesting opportunity here, not just in how things are communicated, but how they're framed, how they're designed. I think there's such an appetite there, certainly that I see on the social innovators, social enterprise side, for those connections. I just really, any advice you've got on that, Giles, I think something that we're crying out for.
Mm, no, I totally agree. In fact, one of the kind of core reasons why we started Gasp is because we collectively were frustrated that the creative minds only got involved when a brief was written. And I felt like so much diagnosis has already happened by that stage. Not to say it was incorrect diagnosis, but I think there's just opportunities missed.
Well, there's an amazing campaign at the moment born out of a charity called F4S called Maths for Girls, which zooms in on this idea that about drop-off in girls studying maths. Now, I don't have any of the answers, but what is interesting to me is some of the numbers, and just to crowd in, and please let them forgive me, they might already be doing this, but to crowd in some of the marketing communications minds around how that could be even more effective as a campaign, I think is just such a lovely open goal.
Mm. Yeah. Especially when so many girls do typically excel at maths in ways that boys don't. I think early on, again, I'm name dropping again here, but I remember Alex Horn talking about one of the observations he has when they do set these tasks within schools. I think one of them is that they typically split into groups of boys and girls, and they're given a random length piece of rope each and asked how long the rope is. And he says the boys will just go mad and start rolling it out and causing chaos. Whereas you'll find there's always one girl who knows her height and so will lie down next to the rope. And he says it's amazing how often it happens. So I'm not familiar with Maths for Girls, but I will I'll look into that and we'll link to that in the episode.
Yeah, no, it's a crack. I love that example.
How do you split your time, Ollie? Because you're involved in so many great initiatives. And of course, you host panels, you moderate, you do so much. You've got a family too. Like, how do you split your time?
Well, depending on the week, not very well. And of course, the catch-all is it depends. As it happens, through this year, as an example, I'm working with two or three organizations. I'm helping start Future Forum, which is about bringing people together across industries to shape the future. I'm working with an eye health agency on a couple of big summits. I'm working with a company called the Super Scalers on how you help particularly underrepresented founders scale through 50 million revenue. In other words, there are projects which appear in my mind, at least, if not in my calendar, pretty much every day. And then the hosting will always be a thread. So MC, chair, presenter, A, because I love it, B, because it's just been such an amazing shortcut to meet interesting people. And that could be a health event, a Future of Energy event. What I have to then do is factor in time for recovery and recharging between some of those things. So I'd say the majority of the events I hosted last year were outside the UK, in the US, across the Middle East, further afield. And then I spend, you know, a healthy chunk, probably a quarter of my time working from home. And a big part of that is reading, thinking, recovering, if that makes sense.
Yeah, total sense. Yeah, makes complete sense. I'm slightly mindful of time, Ollie, so I'm going to go to our listener questions. So asking the general public for their opinion, be it on Brexit or boat names, is notoriously fraught with danger. I'm going to try and squeeze two in, Ollie. Starting with Theo. Theo asks, what makes a really good introduction between two people?
Brilliant question, Theo. The big thought, if I can say that, is this an introduction where one of the parties would like something from the other, which is fine. And there you're drawing on the generosity of one. And or is it something where you really feel both will benefit? That's a dream. I'm not saying you don't get something out of giving something to someone else. In totally practical terms, what I've learned the hard way is you need to explain really clearly how you know each person, because otherwise you'll introduce a lifelong trusted colleague to someone you met last night, which can be hazardous. And my other tip I learned too late is it's okay to just get out the way, encourage them to cross paths and step back. So not to get bogged down in the deal. A lot of people might say, well, hang on, how am I going to get something from this? And I would definitely encourage someone listening to, as much of the time as possible, to let that thought go. I've been lucky enough to introduce people to their future business partners, their future husbands, their future wives, their future clients. The way introducing people impacts their goodwill towards you has come back tenfold in their generosity in future. And so I just think more people should think about the power of introductions more often, to be honest. I think a lot of introductions, my own included, are quite literal. You know, A is looking for B, let me introduce you to B. I think the ones that can be game changers are where they weren't even necessarily specifically asking for each other, but you've spotted a rhyme in some way, which might sound terribly vague, and you've just got a sense that they can benefit each other. I happen to know two very dear friends right now. I've introduced them very recently and they're just about to meet. I happen to know that from very different angles, they're pondering the future of leadership, which might sound terribly grand. And I just have a sense they're going to get on, even though their business cards say something completely different. And I think in that equation is probably their trust of me as well. So they back me to know it's worth having that first coffee.
Yes. Yeah, that makes complete sense. There's kind of a remarkable potential there.
Yeah.
It's not just a value.
But also, you know, Giles, I might say, Giles, I just have a feeling you're going to get on. Just trust me on this one. Just I'd encourage you to cross paths.
Mm. Yeah, nice. Non-committal too. I'm going to read both of Emma's and Shelley's questions out because they're very similar. I hope they don't mind me merging them. So Emma says, how do you actually start building a network if you don't know many people yet? Shelley's point was, what's one small thing people can do to become better connected? So I'm guessing this is all about just, you know, building those connections and networks.
Yeah, I think there's a hard way to do it, which I do encourage, which is reaching out to people to say hello. The shortcut is joining things. And that might be, it could be a chamber of commerce. It could be, a certain club. I mean, mentioned last week, Rebel Book Club is a brilliant thing to join because it's a regular group meeting to talk about a nonfiction book. My life got changed by some of those groups that I joined because it wasn't just one-off meetings, right? It could be an alumni network for an organization you've been part of. But I think, so joining things, having a sense of who around you might be what I think of as like a super connector, someone that just seems to know lots of people. If you can think about who those might be in your existing world, I think that helps enormously. And then just taking time, and this is increasingly hard, I think, with a blank sheet of paper, just to map out a few of the people you know, and then ask yourself the question, who would I like to meet? And that doesn't have to be names of people. It could be types of people. So I'm a songwriter. Who do I need to meet? I probably need to meet some more publishers. I probably need to meet some fellow songwriters for collaborations. I'll probably need to meet people who are, maybe managers or, you know, just to give you an example. But Sure. Only by sketching that out, does that thought process then start?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that makes complete sense. Lovely. Great answer. So the final part of the interview, Ollie, is our four pertinent poses that we put to all of our guests. Starting with, what advice would you give to your younger self?
gosh, apart from save more, look after your back, spend more quality time with your grandparents, I think I did only get into the knack of keeping in touch a bit late on. So I think, you know, practicing that as an exercise, if you like, I wish I'd done that sooner. If I think of the amazing people I met through my first business, but then lost touch with, partly through the shame of losing the business, if I'm honest, I was embarrassed to go back to them and explain what had happened. I also think there was a chapter in my career where I was so keen to keep pushing forward that I wasn't always being as helpful as I could have been to the people in the rooms behind me, if you like. I probably should have started that as a habit. Somebody said last week about, you know, certain technology being, you know, fueled by, I think they said data or whatever it was, but humans are fueled by sleep. And I think there's a lot to that. Everything I've helped to start is a direct result of the amount of sleep I've had when I think about it. Without sounding terribly morbid, Giles, I would say to my former self, design things which survive and strengthen assume no one remembers your name personally, which would be fine by me. Assume that they survive and strengthen, or have to survive and strengthen, if you go under a bus.
Okay. Yes.
You know, because it's very easy to say, well, hang on, I'm going down this presenting line, or I'm being very central to the growth of this initiative. And this is not the pithy answer we're going for, but if I had my time again, I would have helped to create more places and ways for people to connect with each other that were non-reliant on any individual.
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense. Nice. You didn't struggle for answers there in the end. Number two, if you could banish one thing from your industry, what would it be and why? Is there anything in the world of entrepreneurship? And I must say, I've just watched Louis Theroux too last night, and I'm not sure if I don't want to lead the witness here. Is there anything in that world you'd like to banish?
You mean Louis and the Manosphere, do you?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. I mean, and I know that's not your world. I'm not even for one second meaning to suggest it is, but I'm sure a lot of them would describe themselves as entrepreneurs. Yes. What are we banishing?
I mean, I've got two answers. One is a little provocative and maybe more playful. The first slightly dull one is we have an obsession in a lot of the conversations I spend time with in ringing a massive bell and celebrating investment rounds, which is very important. However, I'd like people to celebrate real transactions with real partners and customers more often. I think we can get very, very into the former. But again, clearly raising money has a place. If I can ban anything, and I know this is going to sound deeply ironic and hypocritical at the end of an episode like this, I would ban people talking about themselves. I think it's far more interesting to talk about other people. And I think people always assume that the answer to the question they're being asked has to be about them. And I just don't think it's true. So, I mean, clearly it's helpful to be introspective and it's very generous of you to ask lovely questions. I just think we need to look out there a bit more. And it's not about us. So that's what, only as an experimental game for a month, Giles, I would ban talking about yourself.
And then we can be self-indulgent again. Promise. Okay, lovely. That's a good answer. And are there any books you would recommend to our listeners, Ollie? We've had so many come up in the 7 years we've been running this show, but do you care to add to the Call to Action library?
Yeah, gosh, there are so many. I mean,
are you a reader? Well, I assume you are a reader.
Oh, yeah. I mean, just a whole stack. I mean, the biggest thing on my on my bedside table, it actually tends to be autobiographies and biographies of a range of individuals. If you can wade through it, it's not that accessible language-wise. I still think How to Win Friends and Influence People is the go-to by Dale Carnegie. I still think The Tipping Point by Malcolm Gladwell, if you want to understand the power of connectors in the world. And just in terms of pure smorgasbord, a book by former newscaster Martin Lewis called Reflections on Success, only because it is taking a snapshot of probably 50 individuals from the sporting world, the business world, the world of science, and understanding or sharing what success meant to those people, which, surprise, surprise, isn't just about money. or even career success. So it's books about people, typically a variety of people, which give you a different perspective on how to carve out your path. So that tends to be my sweet spot for a recommendation.
Yeah, nice. Funny enough, that certainly hasn't come up before. How to Win Friends and Influence People and The Tipping Point have, quite rightly. Can I push you for a favourite biography as well?
I mean, purely for, I mean, I go back to autobiographies.
Yeah.
Purely for a thrilling read, I actually thought Bob Iger's Disney book, Going Back to Where My Career Started, Ride of a Lifetime. Have you read that one, Giles?
No, I've not. No, no.
Yeah, Ride of a Lifetime by the former chief exec of Walt Disney is a fantastic read. Purely for merriment, I think Giles, spelt with a Y, Giles Brandreth's political memoirs, only in terms of putting me off going into formal politics, but also because he's so mischievous in terms of just books that will make you think and make you laugh.
Yeah. What's your top book tip recently?
I must just tell you, actually, I crossed it out, but because it was just a bit too surreal. But we actually did have a quick fire of your favourite Giles, which was Ashley Giles or Giles Brandreth. So there we go.
Have you got a book tip for me, Giles?
George Orwell's first book, Burmese Days. It's an absolute cracker.
Oh, I love the sound of that. I'm going to go back to that.
Yeah, it's lovely.
And I would say, by the way, Giles, if I've helped start, let's say, 10 things, I'd say 9 of them have been started as a direct result, on the one hand, of always of reaching out to people saying, fancy a chat about this. But what was the source? And I'm ashamed to say it wasn't direct lived experience of the challenge I was trying to solve. However, it was 9 out of 10 times about reading about that problem in either print form, as in a newspaper, in a book, and really getting a sense of it and thinking, I had no idea this was happening. What can we do about it?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, well said. Well said. Number 4 then, and kind of lastly, Ollie, is we always ask all of our guests to dedicate their episode to someone. So would you dedicate this episode?
Wow. And you must have had lots of answers to that question.
Yeah, we get dedications of all shapes and sizes.
Well, I'm going to say it because it is, we are recording this on the 16th of March, which is a Monday. And yesterday was Mother's Day. And that is the slyly flippant way of framing it. I don't think mums get enough credit. So I would definitely dedicate this to my mum. Why? Because she's a legend. B, she gave me a quotation by former US President Calvin Coolidge when I was a teenager. And the essence of the quotation was, nothing will take the place of persistence.
Nice.
And talent won't, and intellect won't, and so on. And for that and a billion other reasons, although my dad was always the higher profile one, shall we say, I have almost everything to say thanks to her for on that, and for a billion other reasons. So that's who it would be dedicated to.
Oh, fantastic. It was easy for me, and very proud to dedicate this episode to her. That's a lovely quote, not least because you disappointed her by dropping out of Leeds in Edinburgh, but nothing would take the place of persistence. That's lovely. I like that a lot. So as a final call to action then, everyone listening, we've linked to all of the initiatives we have discussed, and no doubt a lot more. We'll link to the books, so How to Win Friends and Influence People, The Tipping Point, Reflections on Success, and Ride of a Lifetime, which I'm certainly going to check out. How else can our listeners get more Ollie Barrett?
Oh, well, that's very kind of you to ask. I'm helping to cook up a new venture, which is Future Forum, so futureforum.co. I try and share what I'm working on at olliebarrett.com. And of course, I'm on LinkedIn as well. And I'd be super grateful if you'd point the way to the campaigns we've talked about, like the 10X Challenge or Fiverr, also the Super Scalers, which is rapidly gaining momentum. And I tend to think of like books on a shelf without sounding a bit simple about it. But, you know, I'm really excited about the volumes that are still to come. And I'm absolutely convinced that none of that's going to happen on my own. So if there are future collaborators out there, I'm here and excited to plot. And if I can be in any way helpful to anyone, especially in the early stages of something, that would make me very happy to try and be useful.
Amazing. Fantastic. Well, we'll link to Future Forum and everything else discussed. But Ollie, listen, thank you so much for joining us. I know I said it pre-recording, but it's so nice to be connected again. It's been a pleasure and it's been a privilege.
Thank you, Giles. Loved spending time together, and kudos to you on the podcast, and very happy to have had the conversation, and just saying hello, and let's keep in touch to the person listening. Thank you.
Finally, thank you to everyone listening. If you've enjoyed the episode, please do share and review the pod. Keep your questions and guest requests coming in. To get in touch, it's easy to find Gasp online or email the mouthful that is calltoaction at gasp.agency.
Call to action. I can't get no call to action. But I try, and I try, and I try, and I try. I can't get no call to action. Yeah, hey, hey.